Stay tuned to the Black Coffee Channel, home of the Cedric Muhammad and Black Coffee Radio program.
All right, let's get to Dead Aid. I've allowed other people to comment on this book, other people raving about it, other people hating on it. Let me say from the start that it's a good read. I like the way that the book is put together. That's the cover right there up if you want to look at it. Dead Aid, Why Aid Is Not Working and How There Is a Better Way for Africa. Dambisa Moyo is the author. Let me give you some audio on her. I think that might be the best way to introduce it. I can give you two interviews that she did that I think are critical to get a handle on. Let me hit you with one. I could go a couple ways with this. Let me give you one from her on CNBC.
So, obviously, it's been an incredible couple months, right? I mean, you go from you're out there trying to make a difference, and now all of a sudden you've got a bestseller, and you're on the most influential list of people, all because... So, obviously, it's been a pretty incredible couple months, right? I mean, you go from you're out there trying to make a difference, and now all of a sudden you've got a bestseller, and you're on the most influential list of people, all because you come out and say, maybe aid isn't a good thing. What's your bottom line premise?
We can do development much better in Africa. It's home to over 60% of the African population is under the age of 24, and Africans desperately want job opportunities and to be entrepreneurs. My message is very simple. We need to stop focusing on aid and handouts and really start to focus on the things that will deliver long-term growth and reduce poverty.
And what is that? If not aid, then what?
Well, it's a combination of trade and foreign direct investment, the capital markets, microfinance, savings, remittances. These are things that will spur economic growth and will also reduce poverty. We know that this works. This is the combination of things that has worked across the African continent in places like South Africa and Botswana, but in places like China and India, Brazil and Russia. So the real focus here is on job creation, and that's something that aid cannot do.
And how specifically has aid failed in that? I mean, aid has been tried in other countries around the world and been much more successful. And yet in Africa, it never seems to get very many countries above the bar.
Well, I think the type of aid interventions that have tended to work, as I talk about in the book, are things that have been short, sharp, and finite, not the open-ended commitments that pervade the African continent today. And I think that's critically important, because what you want is to make sure that governments are incentivized to get a private sector going. And unfortunately, in an aid system, it allows governments, in many cases, to be quite lazy, and in other words, not focus on developing a private sector.
And so if not aid, then what? How do you get big companies or even microfinance opportunities into Africa when so many people are so afraid of, well, the regime might change or the rules might change? How do you get that invested?
Well, I hope I'm one of the new voices coming out of the African continent, which are positive. There's so many amazing things going on in the continent. We've spent so much time focusing on the negatives, and that's one of the things I have a problem with right now, is that the celebrity culture is so focused on the negative things. They talk about war and disease and poverty and corruption, and yet there's a vibrant young population coming up who are very excited and keen to participate in the global economy. Many, many countries are looking for young people, and Africa is home to that. We've got an amazing story in terms of land, arable land, and in terms of the mining sectors, and in terms of retail sectors. I mean, there's so many that are so positive, and I think it's really important to focus on that rather than focus on the old staid model of aid and the negative story that's attached to that.
Do you think that aid is, in some fundamental way, condescending? Or it's sort of having pity for people when pity isn't necessarily what they need?
Oh, Africans definitely don't need pity. We're basically a proud continent. And it's a great pity that Africa and Africans are portrayed in such a negative fashion around the world. I mean, this is a continent that has got so many things going for it. And I think that's the message that we're trying to push now. We're ready for change. We're ready to go on the right path, the path that is tried and tested across the continent. And I really hope that will be the thing that spurs us to the next, into the 21st century.
You have caused all sorts of tidal waves of conversation about this issue. And some have criticized you for saying, well, Dambisa Moyo is against any kind of charity. She says we shouldn't be giving bed nets to children in Africa when that's trying to fight malaria. Is that really what you're saying?
No. You know what? People are being deliberately obtuse, and I think it's actually intellectually dishonest to misquote me in such an obvious way. And what do I mean by that? I mean, obviously, the best and most sustainable solution is for Africans to produce the bed nets so that people get an employment, and then we can produce bed nets on the African continent. Is there anything wrong with that? No. Of course, in the interim, there is scope for charitable interventions. I myself sit on the board of a number of charities. However, I understand those type of interventions to be band-aid solutions. They're not going to get Africa to grow at the requisite rates of growth to actually put a dent in poverty. And so I think we need to understand what those type of charitable interventions can and cannot do. We're looking for job creation on this continent. Aid has never created jobs for Africans, and it's critically important for us to remember that.
Many Americans watching tonight may think, what can they do? They may have given money to charities, as an example, and they may say, well, should I not do that? Should I do something different? What should I do? What would you tell them?
Well, I would tell them that it's fine to give money to charity as long as you understand what the limitations of that charity is. You're trying to create a sustainable long-term solution here. And so there are many things that people can do on an individual basis. I've talked a lot about things like Kiva.org, which is an American-based computer interface where you can lend money to entrepreneurs for as little as $25 anywhere on Earth.
And then they pay you back.
Of course. And that's,
but you're helping them get started.
Exactly. And that's critically important because you need to get the right incentives going. You need people to be incentivized to do the right thing. And unfortunately, an aid-based system does not incentivize many governments in Africa to do the right thing. And that's what I think is missing.
So when you define aid, obviously the bulk of traditional aid is low-cost loans from governments to African governments. How do you feel, let's say, about some of the major charitable folks, is the Fund for Malaria, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and some of their efforts? Are those things that should also be changed?
Well, there are three types of aid. There's humanitarian or emergency aid. So that's the kind of aid that would go to Fargo or to Katrina,
right,
or to an earthquake or a flood or tsunami. I have no qualms with that. And this is a lot from page 7 of my book, where I talk about the fact that there is a moral imperative for us to act as part of a global society, mm-hmm, to actually do something when other people are on the verge of crisis. Of course. The second type of aid is the NGO and charitable aid. And I guess I'll point to what I said earlier, which is basically that, yes, it might do something, but it's very much a band-aid solution. What we're trying to get to is a point where we get long-term solutions and job creation. Unfortunately, yes, a scholarship can send a girl to school, but it's not likely to help the economy to grow at 10%, for example, which could actually put a dent in poverty on a permanent basis. So my advice is, you know, people can go ahead and give money to charities, but understand what the limitations are. Then, of course, the final type of aid, which is my book is really criticizing, is this $1 billion of government-to-government aid flows that do go into Africa every year, which unfortunately, in the worst-case scenario, fuel corruption. And in the best-case scenario, in many places across the African continent, allow governments to abdicate their responsibility of providing public goods like education and healthcare, security, and even infrastructure. So basically, it allows governments to have somebody else from outside come in and provide those goods.
Well, it would seem like one of the goals would be, I mean, just to be honest with you, is for people like you who go overseas and get amazing educations to choose to come home.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's what the goal would be,
oh,
right?
Absolutely.
That instead of saying, oh, if I want to do something amazing, I have to leave.
Yeah. And we're seeing that trend. I mean, many countries that where the governments are speaking the right language, they are concerned about economic development, they are focused on private sector development and free press and so on, all that good stuff that we really like to see. For those type of countries, we are seeing a trend of Africans going back home. And I think that we will see momentum in that space if there are opportunities for entrepreneurs. It's very simple. Africans want what everybody else wants. They want jobs. They do not want handouts. They want jobs.
Well, they want jobs. They want cars and washers.
Absolutely.
And dryers and all of those things. And what about China? Now, China has been criticized heavily that they go in with investment, and when they do deliver, they either bring Chinese workers in instead of providing African jobs, as one criticism, and then the other is they give money with no strings attached, as in no strings in you need to be a democracy or you need to help your people.
Is
China's way bad, or is that completely an unfair thing to say?
Oh, I think it's fundamentally unfair. I think that what the Chinese have done in Africa is to transform the playing field. The Chinese come to Africa very simply for business, and there is an opportunity for Africans to get jobs in that type of an environment. Now, of course, there are environmental issues, there are labor issues, but that's where African policymaking needs to kick in. And, you know, just to quote somebody from Africa, last week I was at home in Zambia, and it was very interesting because people said to me, well, the Americans borrow from the Chinese, and we don't hear anybody up in arms about that. And same in Europe. There are a lot of European companies are being sold to the Chinese, and nobody's quibbling about their human rights record and so on and so forth. So, I mean, we need to remember that Africans are adults. African policymakers can stand up and say, you know what, Mr. China, we love you being here and bringing your investment, but please can you focus on making sure that Africans can benefit from your largesse?
Right, so it should be the governments that tell China how to operate.
It is African
China should be telling them how to run their country.
So absolutely. African governments are charged with that responsibility. They are elected by African people to act on their behalf, and therefore it is their responsibility to stand up and speak on behalf of the African people.
So you're saying that the traditional model of aid has failed. How has it failed, and what should we replace it with?
Fundamentally, the problem with the aid model is that it's not creating jobs across the African continent. And very much the aid interventions tend to be band-aid solutions, such as providing malaria nets or providing HIV drugs, which are important, but they are very, very narrow in the sense that they will not be able to generate long-term economic growth. What we need is job creation, and that requires investment. And so I think it's critically important for us to focus on investment, such as, for example, microfinance. This is one way in which you can actually finance an entrepreneur on the ground in Africa. But of course, at the more macro level, you can get more foreign direct investment, so sort of what we've seen from the Chinese in recent years.
And when you talk about microfinance, I mean, that's something where individual Americans who currently, say, donate to a charity could actually instead give a very small loan to an individual somewhere
in Africa.
Absolutely,
absolutely. I mean, this model has really taken off in places like in Bangladesh under the auspices of Grameen Bank, for which Muhammad Yunus won the Nobel Prize a few years ago. And yes, it absolutely is exactly that. You basically use the monies that you have, instead of just giving it to charity as a handout, you basically give it to finance entrepreneurs on the ground in Africa.
Cedric Muhammad, Black Coffee Program. Let me... There's a lot of material there to work with. Dambisa Moyo. She worked at Goldman Sachs for 8 years. Previously, she worked for the World Bank as a consultant. She completed a PhD in economics at Oxford University and holds a master's from Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. She was born and raised in Lusaka, Zambia. So she has Western credentials. Now, let me hold up the book. This is the book, Debt Aid. Go get it. It's very black folk friendly. Only 154 pages. Debt Aid. Go get it. We can build on it. Now, let me be her bodyguard for a minute, because I don't want to talk about this book in terms of left, right, center. I want to talk about it in terms of 5, 10. 85%, which we'll review soon. It's a great book. Her argument is that, which you just heard her make better than I can summarize it, that African governments are actually being hurt by the amount of aid that they're getting. If you want to get a similar argument, it has to do with the principle that some people say is in effect when a person receives welfare for too long and they begin to get lazy. There's certain things they won't do. They lose their initiative. So Dambisa is saying that's happening to African governments. African governments are losing their initiative. They're becoming lazy. And the work that people like Bono and others are claimed to be doing, African governments could be doing. Strong argument. Now, there's certain areas that Dambisa Moya won't go into because if she did, the book wouldn't be as popular as it is now. I'll go into some of those arguments, okay? There's a list of things where I disagree with her. I got about 10 things here. I'm a little hesitant to go into them. I think that she makes an important argument that we should lift up, which is that foreign aid is not good for Africa. I don't think she places enough stress on the fact that foreign aid is actually used to control African governments. She doesn't really focus on the external motivation for foreign aid. She doesn't really deal with the cause. She deals with the effect. If Africa were to get off of foreign aid, it still, to me, would have the same problems it has now, because trade agreements are structured with the same motivation that aid is given. To control Africa and give Africa the raw end of the bargain and keep Africa in a dependent state so that the raw materials can be extracted from the continent where they are needed more desperately, which is in the West. So that would not change. If you got rid of all the foreign aid like Dambisa is saying, you still would have to deal with trade and the debt issue, which keeps Africa enslaved. Now, I don't think she could say what I just said and have a book be this popular. She also could not get into arguments like the economic hitman. Get the book Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Dambisa is not going to get into any of that. She does not get into any of that in this book. So let me be her bodyguard. She could not write a book and have it this well received if she got into covert operations, why aid is given to countries, why trade agreements are structured the way they are, why debt is structured the way it is. The other thing that Dambisa hints at, but she does not outright state, is that if Africa is going to get out of this problem, it needs to unite on a regional basis. She mentions how African governments could come to the capital markets internationally and take out loans, and the loans would be on better terms for Africa if the countries did so as a group. And she's right. She talks about the need for African economies to work more closely together so that their markets will be common. People will not have to deal with different dilemmas. You know, for instance, let me give an example. When you go from New Jersey down to North Carolina, from North Carolina down to Florida, you don't have to deal with messy customs borders and things like that. Africa needs to get something similar to that going in each of their regional areas and continental wide. So she does a good job of mentioning that. However, Dambisa does not outright call for the strengthening of regional economic communities in North Africa, Central Africa, East, West, and Central. As I said before, the Abuja Treaty in 1991, which is the basis for the African Economic Community, says that the best approach to uniting Africa economically is to take regional building blocks, East, West, North, South, Central. Dambisa hints that regional economic communities are the way to go, but she does not advocate for it. Everything for her boils down to getting rid of foreign aid. So I think she puts too much emphasis on that, but it's such an important point that I'll be her bodyguard. Let me protect her on another area. A lot of people will note her strong Western background. She went to Goldman Sachs. Let me read the 101 on her. She worked at Goldman Sachs. She worked for the World Bank. She completed a PhD in economics at Oxford University. And she has a master's from Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. Yet she was born and raised in Lusaka, Zambia. Now, you and I both know the 10% would like to use her to forward their agenda so that one day she would be something like the president of Zambia. Now, we know that may be in the mind of certain people while they're lifting her up, while they're giving her such a great platform, publishing excerpts of her book. No Pan-Africanist gets this kind of love. So I don't want Dambisa Moyo to be Cedric Muhammad. I don't want her to be Kwame Nkrumah. I want her to be herself. However, there's a reason why she can't write the book that would tell the kind of truths that I'm saying. And it has to do with the weakness in the Black nationalist Pan-Africanist community worldwide and the Africanist community in Africa, which is dependent upon grant money. The same things that she's talking about in terms of government, it's going on with NGOs. These are non-governmental organizations. The leading scholars and academics in Africa are getting grant money from the West. It hinders your ability to make truthful and free-thinking kind of analysis and economic recommendations. If there were a group of people who would support her, then yeah, she could write the book that would tell more truth. So some people complain about Dambisa's book along the lines of what I just mentioned. It does not go far enough. It doesn't promote African unity as an economic model. It doesn't say Africa needs a single currency. It doesn't say that the regional economic communities need to be strengthened along the lines of the Abuja Treaty. It doesn't say really anything about the African Union. I don't know that she mentions the African Union at all in her book. Well, what would be the cost if she did? See, everybody wants everybody to run out on a limb and tell the truth, but the reality is you don't get financial support when you do that from your own. Talk about that a little bit more later. Okay, let me give you some more audio on Dambisa. She was on Q&A several months ago I got the audio. Oh, some of you all. She's pleasing to the eye, yes. This is part of her appeal. There's a pose that she got. Look at this pose, y'all. Hold on. Yeah, I know everybody's running over to their computer right now. I think this is the shot. Look at that. Goodness gracious. Now, I did not put the shot there. The camera did that naturally. We have got to protect her. Can you imagine all the men in Europe, in France, in England, at Oxford University? I must work hard to get her into the garment of the Sudanese journalist. This is Dambisa Moyo striking a pose for the West, no doubt, on a Q&A with Brian Lamb. Look at how Brian Lamb tries to hint and walk her into basically saying it's white people who are behind my book. In so many words.
This week on Q&A, our guest is Dambisa Moyo, a Zambian-born economist who has worked at the World Bank and at Goldman Sachs. Her new book is called Dead Aid, Why Aid Is Not Working and How There Is a Better Way for Africa.
Dambisa Moyo, would you tell the story about the fellow that got on the motorcycle and rode the entire continent of Africa?
Yes. This is the story of a mining entrepreneur who decided to do a motorbike tour from Cairo to Cape Town a couple of years ago. And he basically rode through 15 countries over about 5 weeks. And about 85% of the roads that he rode on were tarred, as he described the California-style tarred, so amazingly tarred roads. And he couldn't quite understand why that would be the case. I must say I myself was quite surprised to hear that such a long distance, which is, by the way, three times the distance between New York and Los Angeles, could be almost completely tarred. And the story, basically, he finds out, is that most of that infrastructure has been put in place by the Chinese. And so I thought it was a remarkable story of how in just 5 to 10 years the Chinese have done arguably something that the West and African partners in the past 60 years have failed to do.
How did they do it?
Through investment. The reality is that the approach that the Chinese have taken is one of going into Africa, seeking business partnerships. They're not perfect, of course. A lot of the Western media tends to focus pretty much on the negative, unfortunately. But essentially, they are laying down infrastructure across the African continent as part of contracts or as part of ways for them to invest in the continent, to perhaps sometimes to extract as return for extracting minerals, but also in general for them to be able to transport goods on the continent.
Well, I did want to follow up and ask you, why do you think the Chinese are doing it? You kind of touched on it a little bit, but are they building these roads and just leaving them for the Africans to use with no specific return? Or are they being paid somehow to put those roads down?
Oh, no. I mean, it's part of contracts. So the fact that the Chinese come in with investment capital and agree to build roads or railways, in return, they get access to minerals and mining and perhaps sometimes oil and gas concessions. So it's basically in return for that.
Well, at two different times in your book called Dead Aid, I saw this name. Lucas London?
Yes, that's right.
And then I saw on the website that you have been nominated to be on the board of the London Petroleum Company.
That's right, yeah.
Can you connect those two, Lucas and the fellow who's the chairman, is Ian?
Yes, Ian.
So who are? How do you know the Londons?
So I met them actually about 3.5 years ago, and I actually currently sit on their board, their charity board, at the Clinton Global Initiative I believe now 2007. As part of pledges that were being made at the conference, the Lundin for Africa Foundation, of which I'm one of the board members, made a significant pledge towards microfinance initiatives across Africa. And I have been part of that organization as a charitable member. It's been an incredible opportunity to really focus on real opportunities and ways to intervene and participate in Africa through a more entrepreneurial approach rather than just handing over cash.
The audience saw on the screen the website of the Lundin, the members of the board, and when you see that, group right there, you're going to look very different in that group. Why do they want you in the middle of that group?
Oh, well, I mean, I have not yet been fully incorporated into the board. So that's hopefully coming up quite soon. I would look, knowing the Lundins as I do, and knowing the other board members, I know that it's got nothing more to do than the fact that they believe that I bring a different perspective to their organization. Of course, you know, my background is somewhat different in the sense that I'm a trained economist. Many of the people on the board are mining and geology background, but also, you know, as somebody who comes from Africa, I do offer a different perspective on perhaps some of the things that may, where there may be opportunities.
Swedish company?
Swedish company, yes.
And do they do business in Africa?
They do business in Africa. However, they have just recently sold out of a large position of a big stake that they had on the continent.
Dead Aid, the book, it's been all over the papers. I'm sure you're, I don't know. Are you surprised that the Wall Street Journal gave you a whole excerpt, an editorial, they did a book review?
Okay, let me break in. This is what I'm talking about. Now, I'm going to blog on this, God willing, next week. This deals with the crisis of the black and African intellectual who has no real financial support or institutional backing. Brian Lamb is trying to dig down on how is it that a black woman could write a book like this and get so much of an embrace from the Western media. I mean, big time mainstream media. Neil Ferguson writes the foreword to her book. Neil Ferguson, the great monetary historian who, you know, accidentally wrote the book on the Rothschilds and forgot to mention the slavery connections, but we'll let that go for now. How is it that Dambisa Moyo can get embraced by the Wall Street Journal, by Neil Ferguson, by all of these, Steve Forbes, all of these writers? So he's trying to suggest something about her credibility, I think, to taint her. But again, I will defend her because she could not have written the book that maybe some of us would have liked to, because there is no backing for such a book from the people that you're writing it for. Now, in addition to that, she raises an incredibly important point about aid dependency. I happen to think there's trade dependency, debt dependency, because there's something called a least developed country economy that we've talked about. You're not going to unwind the colonial economy just by ending foreign aid. That's where I may disagree with her, but I will defend her because we need more and more people to make arguments like this who can navigate the world of Western media smoothly. She's heavily westernized, yet she has credibility and loves her country, and she wants to give back. Some people, I'm suggesting, would want to use that to build her up, give her such a foundation that next thing you know, she's running for the president of Zambia in their interest and not ours. So listen closely to what Brian Lamb is suggesting, subtly and not so subtly.
They couldn't do anymore. Where's that coming from?
Well, I'm very, very grateful for the attention that the book has garnered. I think, you know, I'm grateful and flattered in the sense that we're in the middle of arguably one of the greatest economic crises of recent times, and so to get that space to remind us as a society that there is there are other incredibly pressing issues on the table, it's a great thing. However, of course, I do think that there are a number of organizations that are perhaps deliberately misinterpreting what I'm saying. The book is about government-to-government aid. It's not about humanitarian aid. It's not about charitable aid. Those two types of aid do have problems, for sure, but this book is specifically discussing government-to-government aid flows. But you know, beyond that, if this book has generated debate about the problems of depending on long and open committed aid flows, then I've done my job.
But you've gotten a lot of attention in the Financial Times of London. You got a big interview in the New York Times. You've appeared on a number of shows. Again, how is this happening all of a sudden? Because a lot of people pushing books. What do you think they're interested in?
I do think that, you know, it's serendipity in a sense. We are in a time where I think people are questioning the status quo. I mean, just look at the amount of focus that we've given to the capitalistic free market system. And I think that there are many things that people are now taking a step back and saying, well, hang on, maybe what we thought was okay and acceptable is not exactly the case. And I think the aid model is right up there. We've got close to 1 billion people living in dire economic conditions, and their situation is getting worse. and we're actually prescribing and getting excited about pushing more aid to Africa when that's actually not sustainable. It's got no evidence of long-term sustainable growth anywhere in the world.
Can you remember the first moment you thought about this book?
The critique of aid has been something that has grown with me as a young girl in Zambia. But also, it's become much more of an important project as I've spent time living abroad, had the fortune of good fortune of being able to live here in the United States, but also living abroad and working not only in multilateral aid institutions such as the World Bank, but also being at an investment bank. And also, I might add, having been taught by Jeffrey Sachs and Paul Collier, who are very, very focused on developmental issues, it became something that became very much an interest because I have lived that reality.
I want to go specifically, though. When did you think about this book, FS&G? When did they buy it, and why did they buy it?
So this book was, if I remember correctly, we sold the rights to the book in 2006 summer. And so it's been a labor of love. I mean, I was working in an investment bank at the time I was writing
the
book.
You're Goldman Sachs at the time?
That's right, yes. I've been at Goldman Sachs for 8 years. I was very happy. I must say, it wasn't sort of a slam dunk. I think that there were issues about whether or not there was appetite for this type of subject, and really, what was there going to be a sort of fundamental message? I was very keen not to just have a negative message. I really wanted to add to the debate by saying, here are some solutions.
But go back to what you were doing. Were you in London with Goldman Sachs?
I was, yes. I was in London with Goldman Sachs.
And what was your job?
So the most recently, I'd been there as an economist, but at the time when I was looking at getting a book contract, I was working in the capital markets, and some of the countries I was responsible to bring into the markets are places like Israel and Turkey and South Africa and Botswana. So here we have a collection of emerging economies that I was helping to access the international capital markets. And I had also spent time at the World Bank, where I was working with more sort of economically challenged countries. And so it was a real opportunity for me to think, well, hang on a second, why is there sort of an A-class and B-class type countries? There's some countries that we're dealing with here as countries that can access the international capital markets through bonds, and there are other countries who, you know, we never hear a pitch from them, and they're mainly African countries. So that's how it evolved.
Well, let's just go back to, you know, your job at Goldman Sachs in London. When you would go to work every day, you're talking about capital markets.
Yeah.
What does that mean to the uninitiated?
Sure. So it's basically about governments and companies looking to borrow money to invest in their programs. So what they do is they come to a place like an investment bank, and they ask investment banks to act as introducers or brokers so that these countries or companies can be introduced to people, investors who would be interested in lending money.
Okay, Botswana, one of 53 African countries, 1 billion people in Africa. You grew up in Zambia. Had you ever been to Botswana?
Yes,
when you
I
were
have,
up?
Yeah, and a completely different situation to my country. Botswana was gained independence from Britain in 1966, and essentially since its independence, it decided to take a very different tack from the rest of the continent, focusing on free markets and a more capitalistic approach to economic development, and also having a very clear and open democratic society. That's very different from the rest of the continent, which actually adopted very aggressively the aid model and has tended to, you know, for many years myself lived under a one-party state.
What's the difference between Botswana and Zambia, and how far apart are they in Africa?
They're next door to each other in terms of physical location. Botswana is a single A-rated country, which is sort of on par with Israel, for example. So there's been a running joke about how Botswana might end up lending money to Japan at some point because it has done remarkably well. It's a relatively small country, but it's definitely very focused in terms of generating long-term development and reducing poverty. And compared to a place like Zambia, which is decidedly a low-income country, Botswana is a middle-income country.
When you say in your book that 600 million of the billion people in Africa are living in poverty, can you describe what that means?
It means that for many of those 600 million, they're living on less than $1 a day. There is dire poverty. They walk long distances for water. Their livelihoods have become worse, not better, in the past 6 years when over $1 trillion has gone to Africa. They don't send their kids to school. Even if it's if the education is free, very often people feel that there's very little long-term benefit because the countries are not growing, and so there isn't a job opportunity for their daughter or son or daughter to get a job anyway when they come out of school because the countries are not growing. In many countries, people live either under a despotic rule, failed states, as you're aware, exist, and the basic things that people in the West take for granted, such as education, healthcare, infrastructure, and even security, are things that are not taken for granted at all. In fact, barely exist.
How many people live in Zambia and how many people live in Botswana?
Zambia has a population of 10 million, about 10 million. Botswana has about a million people. Both countries have been ravaged by the HIV/AIDS crisis. Basically, the population demographics have reflected that.
When was Zambia made a free country, and what colony was it?
Zambia, like Botswana, was a British colony. It was called Northern Rhodesia, and gained independence in 1964.
And then why did these two countries, in your opinion, develop differently?
Clearly, leadership has something to do with it. But I will also say that if you think about back to the 1960s, it was the period where we were all, I think we as in the global society, were enthralled and perhaps taken by the notion that governments could and should intervene. I myself believe that it's critically important for governments to be involved and take a leadership role, active leadership role in designing long-term development policies and strategies. I think what has happened is that the world was very focused on getting much more aid to these African countries. It was on the back of the Marshall Plan. It was post-World War II. The Marshall Plan success, people used that as an argument to buttress this aid flows to Africa.
Coming back to Goldman Sachs for a minute, you said you did Turkey, Israel, and Botswana. Why would they give you those three particular countries?
And South Africa. It was the focus of the bank at the time for that region. There are other colleagues in my team who were focused on Eastern European countries and so on. So it was really just my little fiefdom were those countries, amongst working with other people.
You're sitting at your desk at Goldman Sachs. You are responsible for Botswana. How does it work? Does somebody call you or do you call them? And what is exchanged then? I mean, in common layman terms.
Sure. These are relationships that are built over time. So we spend a lot of time talking to the government officials about what their plans are for these countries and to see whether there were ways to bridge gaps, financing gaps. So, for example, if you're a government and you're looking to fund schools, roads, and healthcare, you might say, well, I can get some of that money from taxes. I might be able to get some of that money from trade, encouraging trade in my country or increasing the private sector, but there might still be a shortfall. And the capital markets are one way through issuing bonds that a country might be able to get money.
Where did this all start for you? Zambia, I know you said you were born. What were your parents doing when you were born?
So my parents are really the pioneers and I very much in the generation of Obama's father. They are Africans who were born and raised in the colonial period. They were relatively young when these countries achieved independence. They came, like Obama's father, to the United States on scholarships to further their education. They were incredibly excited about going back to Africa. It was a turning point. Africans were now taking over responsibility for their destiny. I have quipped that they were kind of the "yes we can" period of Africa, now when I speak to my parents, it's a very different time. At the time, this was a lot of focus on Pan-Africanism. It was a time when Africans had a lot of dignity and self-respect, and they still do. But the focus was really on that Africans were going to determine their future.
So then why wouldn't she support a United States of Africa in what she argues? Just think about it. Why, with such a powerful critique, is that missing from her book and from her public expressions? I have my opinion. I'm going to write something, God willing, next week about what the new crisis of the black and the African intellectual is. You can't really say 100% truth the way you want, because there's no institution that will back you in the Pan-African world. So you have to fit what you say into language that either the Western media, financial community, governmental multilateral world, or community will back. So either it's very technical and you'll get the backing of some foundations, some multilateral organizations perhaps, or it's very single variable. Her book says the problem is single variable, and then she offers a multivariable solution. It's a good book. Go get the book. But think out loud as to why it took so long for her to arrive on the scene and why she couldn't write the book that is really implied in what she's saying and not saying. We'll be right back, heading to hour number, what, four? Tiny and Toya in the T.O. show coming up. I just wanted to give you a good background on Dambisa Moyo. I'm her bodyguard now, self-appointed. I understand why she's doing what she's doing, and the good that she's doing so much outweighs the incomplete part of her presentation that I want to lift her up.
You are a communist, are you not?
No, Mr. Bringier. I am not a communist. I'm Marxist-Leninist.
You are not a communist, but you are a Marxist-Leninist? What is the difference?
You are tuned in to The Watchman, Cedric Muhammad, on the Black Coffee Channel.
August 5th, 2009. That's The Clash. Anybody got a problem with that? That's hot. Magnificent Seven. Who are they talking about in that song? Hillary Clinton is in Kenya. I think this may explain why President Obama spoke in Ghana first. Listen up.
U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton will hold bilateral discussions with her South African counterpart, Maite Ngwane Mashabane, during a four-day visit to the country. South Africa's Department of International Relations says talks will focus on setting up a mechanism to regulate political and economic relations. There will also be discussions on collaborating in the fight against tuberculosis and HIV/AIDS and strengthening educational, scientific, and cultural cooperation. Clinton is scheduled to arrive in the country tomorrow. Now she has arrived in Nairobi, Kenya. One of her first engagements will be to address a forum of some 40 African states focusing on trade and investments.
Human rights groups want Mrs. Clinton to pressure Nairobi to address a 2008 post-election violence. The United States wants Kenya's leaders to hold to account those responsible for the human rights abuses committed in the aftermath of the election. During her seven-nation tour, Mrs. Clinton will also hold talks with Somali leaders in Nairobi. She'll reinforce President Barack Obama's anti-corruption message at the annual trade meeting established by a U.S. program that allows countries in sub-Saharan Africa to export more than 6,400 goods to the United States without paying duties. The United States is looking at ways to boost trade with the 48 countries in sub-Saharan Africa. Mrs. Clinton will also visit South Africa, Nigeria, Angola, Liberia, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Cape Verde.
Trying to make a statement about anti-corruption, but right now America is competing with China for the resources of Africa. I'm going to read your comments, some good ones, about Dambisa Moyo's book and what she's saying. We had a little bit of a debate over the minimum wage in America. They're getting busy in Haiti, over the minimum wage.
Haitian police fired tear gas at protesters who marched outside parliament to demand an increase in the minimum wage. The protesters say they're unable to feed and shelter their families on less than $2 a day. The protest came as parliament prepared to vote on a bill that could raise the minimum wage.
The march began peacefully as the demonstrators, mostly factory workers, walked through the streets of Port-au-Prince to Parliament. However, things turned violent as police fired tear gas after protesters threw stones. No injuries were reported. Most of the crowd dispersed hours before the Parliament session began with no arrests. The debate has fueled unrest across Haiti, with some critics arguing that an increase would hurt plans to fight widespread unemployment by creating jobs in factories that produce clothing for exports to the United States. Earlier this year, the Haitian Parliament voted in favor of tripling the minimum wage, but the bill was vetoed by President René Préval, who wanted to exclude clothing factory workers.
Oh, I had to do a little more religious teaching today. I pulled out the Quran earlier. I might have to pull the Quran out again. Listen to this ridiculous story coming from Northern Virginia about the reaction to an Islamic school, I think, getting a land permit. This is Northern Virginia, 2009. Listen to the arguments against an Islamic school taking root.
Off the top tonight, an Islamist school accused of radical teachings, leaving a Virginia community divided. Tonight, the campus has been given the go-ahead to expand, but the Fairfax Board of Supervisors vote was far from unanimous, and opponents tonight are not holding back. Fox News' Wisdom Martin is live in the newsroom with the News Edge.
Yes, this reporter's name in Washington, D.C. is Wisdom Martin. Wisdom Martin. Shout to his parents.
On this one, Wisdom.
Well, Laura, it started with questions about traffic and safety. Then it turned into, do they have the right to teach and believe what they want? It was all up to the County Board of Supervisors to sort it all out. The first motion to deny the school's application for expansion failed, but the second motion to approve it passed, and the people against it were outraged.
We need to resist these people. We need to make it clear that they may have bought six votes in there, but they're not buying my vote.
James Lafferty stormed out of the boardroom just moments after the supervisors approved the Islamic Saudi Academy expansion in Fairfax County. He wasn't the only one. Dozens of others followed.
I find it shocking that six of them would vote for it, frankly. I'm not sure who's concerned they're really looking out after.
The Islamic Saudi Academy has been surrounded in controversy for years. One of their graduates was implicated in a plot to kill the president.
And how they could overlook a graduate from the school doing that and say they're such fine students. They're fine students, but they're learning the wrong thing for Americans.
Some were concerned about what the academy was teaching. They say the content was anti-American and violent.
They didn't feel the curriculum was something that was appropriate in a land use setting. For example, we don't evaluate the curriculum of other schools that come before the Planning Commission of Board, such as the Catholic school.
And then there was the issue of traffic and congestion. Some argue the road for the proposed site was too small and dangerous.
I think a lot of the charges that were directed at the school were misplaced.
But in the end, the Board of Supervisors said this was only about land use, giving the school the green light to expand, leaving those in opposition seeing red. Lafferty says the decision won't be forgotten come election time.
We will support, even if it's Pee Wee Herman, we'll support whoever's running against them.
Well, now the Academy must go through the entire planning process. Now, Supervisor Gary Hyland of Mount Vernon says the school has been in his district for the last 15 years, and he called them a significant teaching facility. Laura?
Wisdom, thank you.
Wisdom Martin, that's my new favorite announcer in the Washington, D.C. area. His parents named him Wisdom Martin. I think his parents gave him that name. Remember the basketball player named God, Sham God? God, Sham God. That was my man. So someone made a comment that the school did not reflect the Judeo-Christian values of America. Now, how stupid is that? The Quran mentions, Holy Quran mentions respect for Moses and Jesus. Christians don't show any overt respect for Muhammad coming from the scripture that they believe in, the Old Testament and the New Testament, the Torah, or the Injil, the Gospel. Yet Muslims believe Moses and Jesus to be prophets. How can a Muslim not show respect for Judeo-Christian values? when Moses and Jesus are revered prophets of Islam? Stupid. I mean, just say you don't like dark-skinned people. Save us the trouble. You don't want sand enters in your neighborhood. I mean, but don't come out there running something that you heard on the right television outlets, media outlets. The Islam does not reflect Judeo-Christian values, or the school doesn't reflect Judeo-Christian values. And since when is the educational affiliation of anyone who planned to kill anyone, any public figure, a question? Where did John Hinckley go to school? You feel me? I mean, where did John Wilkes Booth go to school? Where did Lee Harvey Oswald allegedly he shot the president? Where did he go to school? So now, because someone who planned to kill someone went to a Muslim school, now you want to hurt that school. I'm glad those people voted against that nonsense. Next time you hear someone say something stupid like that, just have them read the Quran. Have you ever read the Quran? Do you know what the Quran says about Moses or Jesus? Stupid. It's the Bible and it's the Torah and the Gospel that don't overtly say anything about Muhammad. If you were to ask an informed question. Okay, they got that thing backwards. Alan Greenspan, my economics professor at Rutgers University, used to say two things. Alan Greenspan, that's how he used to say his name, Alan Greenspan, and he used to say America is known for two things. He said America is known for two things: the credit crisis, the potato chip and the credit crunch. Alan Greenspan, and America is known for two things: the potato chip and the credit crunch. Here's Alan Greenspan from This Week, hosted by George Stephanopoulos.
Now for another perspective on the economy, let's bring in former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan. When he joined us last September, his view could not have been more sobering.
This is a once in a half century, probably once in a century type of event.
Is it the worst you've ever seen in your career?
Oh, by far. There's no question that this is in the process of outstripping anything I've seen, and it still is not resolved, and it still has a way to go.
And Alan Greenspan joins us again now. Welcome back. So last September, once in a century event, the worst you'd ever seen. Is it over?
Not quite, but we're getting very close. As the Treasury Secretary just mentioned, there's been a very significant improvement in the financial system. And it's been the financial system where the problems have been.
And collapse isn't going to happen.
Collapse, I think, is now off the table. We were teetering for a while. But I do think that the TARP program, for example, was very helpful in shoring up the capital stock of banks and the like. And not an insignificant event is the $3.5 trillion increase in the stock market value of American corporations. Because those are capital gains, and they flow out throughout the system, and you could see their impact in the credit markets and in the equity markets.
How about the broader economy? Have we hit a bottom, and are we going to see a bounce?
Well, I'm pretty sure we've already seen the bottom. In fact, if you look at the weekly production figures for various different industries, it's clear that we've turned perhaps in the middle of last month, the middle of July. And indeed, you're seeing a major increase in assemblies in auto and trucks before the clunker issue even arose.
Has it helped?
Well, obviously, it's helped. It's an interesting issue. I mean, I have qualms about the concept, but there is no doubt that that very extraordinary response that we saw is a very important indicator that the state of confidence in the economy is beginning to pick up. The clunker program had been put in place 6 months ago, it would probably have been a dud.
Oh, that's interesting, because you also saw about 5 months ago the administration also putting out a credit for first-time home buyers. Has that made a difference?
I think it has, but the problems in home building and home sales and mainly home prices is much broader than that. In fact, the way I would define it is that unless home prices stabilize within, say, maybe 5% down from here, we're going to run into some...
Well, but Case-Shiller has shown that they probably have stabilized.
Well, they have stabilized temporarily. And the problem with the data on home prices is they're very difficult to measure, and they're regional data. It is possible. I don't think it's going to happen. But I do think it is possible that we could get a second wave down. But the important issue is, if we don't, and I think the probability is that we won't, that we are close to stabilization. Under those conditions, you will begin to get a very significant change in the underlying confidence in the consumer area.
And then you might see that in the consumer area, you might see that in the stock market. So that is the trigger, possibly. You say it's unlikely, but that could be the trigger to a second dip.
If you get another dip in a renewed decline in prices, we're going to run into an acceleration of the number of homes that are mortgaged and are underwater. That is, that the value of their properties are less than the debt. If that happens, and clearly looking at the structure of where debt and values are, it would, if, for example, home prices fell by 10% or more, that would create a major acceleration in foreclosures, and I think it could be a factor.
On the other side, what's your best estimate right now of when we're going to see that kind of economic growth that can create jobs, above 2.5%, 3.5%?
Well, first of all, let me just say this, that the unemployment rate is going to continue to rise, but more slowly than it's been. We'll continue to have job loss, but that's slowing as well. It strikes me that we may very well have 2.5% in the current quarter. And the reason is that there's been such an extraordinarily high rate of inventory liquidation that the production levels are well under consumption. And as that slows down, as it has to, I mean, you can't go below zero on inventories, production moves up. And that could be quite significant. So I wouldn't put out of the question that we get.
So you're fairly optimistic right now.
I'm short-term optimistic, but with many caveats. The home price issue being a critical one, and then, as you had me quoted on earlier, the deficit.
Well, that's what I want. That's what I want to press you on, because you watch Secretary Geithner there. He says the administration takes it seriously. They're going to do what it takes. Two questions on that. Do you believe that this health care reform that is now being debated is part of the solution to deficits? And number two, must new revenues be on the table?
I would say yes to both. That there is no question that the core of the problem on the long-term deficit is Medicare, specifically, and health care more generally, in the sense that it affects revenues. This is an issue which, remember, existed the beginning of the year. In fact, Medicare at that point was only half funded. And you can't get around the fact that when you have this big shift in the baby boomers retiring, that things fundamentally change. And my view is that we have to attack both the original shortfall and make sure we fund whatever new initiatives occur in the healthcare area.
Teach Alan Greenspan. He's teaching. October 16, 2007, the first of the baby boomers, 64 million Americans born in between 1946 and now. No, I'm saying it wrong. 64 million Americans born, I think, in a 20-year period from 1946 in the next 20 years. The first one of those became eligible to claim their Social Security, I think Medicare, Social Security, all that stuff, October of 2007. All this stuff about healthcare, all this talk with President Obama, what he's trying to do, what the Republicans are doing, what the medical and pharmaceutical folks want, it's important and it is somewhat related. But the main issue is, how is America going to pay entitlements, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, for the baby boomer generation? 64 million Americans. How are you going to afford to pay that? Greenspan has been on this issue for a long time. He's right. All this stuff about tweaking health care is not getting the job done. The fiscal tsunami is on the way, and America's not prepared.